All right, have I talked about interrupt handling and scheduling and how they interact? Since I was doing DNA, I wanted to talk about this because a comment came up, actually privately over the weekend. Jonathan Smith sent me a note reminding me about a book chapter he wrote, and you don't catch your advisor in sloppy verbiage very often unless your advisor is me. And you certainly don't catch Jonathan Smith in sloppy verbiage very often. Rereading the chapter, and I had known about the work and I'd forgotten about the book chapter, reminded me of an issue and actually led me to see something that's worth bringing up. So the context of the chapter was work. Okay, the context of the work was that the lab that these guys were working in was one of the first labs to play with ATM over fiber. ATM is one of the contenders for high-speed link layer protocol over fiber. And this got to be a big political issue and the wrong answer emerged. But in any case, one of the problems with ATM is, well, it's an interaction between two problems. One is you have an incredibly fast packet rate coming at you, okay? And the other is the packets are short, okay? ATM was designed for 64-byte packets, if memory serves me. And the idea was, ATM was actually designed to do telephony, and then the question was, could you overlay data on top of it? And ATM, I think it's fair to say that the data format of ATM had grown over a long chain of events out of an original system called DataKit. DataKit was constructed as a character switch multiplexer. And it had later been used successfully to do large networking in a circuit switch kind of environment. Okay, so what DataKit showed was, look, once you set up a circuit, it really doesn't matter how long the packets are. Okay. Now, the reason you want fixed packets in a very high-speed switch is you want fixed timing windows in the wire, okay? And if the packets are all the same length, then various kinds of queuing and buffering in your switch fabric become easier. The problem with this is, on the receiving end, you're gonna get a big boxcar of very short packets, okay? Each of these packets in the naive hardware implementation is going to generate an interrupt. And what then happens is that you have to impose another layer of protocol above the ATM layer that does reassembly of larger packets before you hit the machine with an interrupt, because otherwise the machine can't keep up. Okay, and this led to a debate between people advocating ATM on the one side and people advocating a variable length format that amounted to Ethernet over fiber. That's an unfair characterization. On the other side, it was a variable length format and allowed relatively large packets. The larger packet format won. In the course of this work, though, the principals were Brendan Traw, Jonathan Smith, and I'm blocking on who the third guy was who worked on this. I've got it downstairs. We're working on how do you do high-speed interrupt management. Okay. And at the time, they were looking at, you know, an RS 6000 class machine, right, which is now known as a power PC, and a 1 gig link, I think, was the magic number. I don't remember if it was 1 gig or if it was SC192, but anyway, it was fast relative to the speeds of the bus and the processor, and that's the important point. Processors today are a lot faster. And buses are a lot faster than the processor they were dealing with. But the issue is, what's the ratio between the line speed on the network, right, and the sort of feasible system speed? And today, the bottlenecks are the bus speed, the memory speed, and the processor interruptible rate. Okay, so we've got measurements that say, basically, if you let a car do bus mastering DMA and you put a high-speed network on it, you can really easily chew up half of your main memory bandwidth just moving those packets into memory. Okay. Now, that sounds like a lot. I mean, it seems like, wait a minute, should I be using half of my capacity for packets I haven't even looked at yet? This is just to get them into the buffers. Worse than that, come at it from the other side, think about what's happening on the CPU, right? The limiting factor in the CPU now, right, is memory access. So you gotta ask, if I wanna run the CPU, what percentage of the main memory bandwidth is the CPU gonna eat? And the answer is, it depends on how many layers of caching you have up to a point, but in fact, enough that losing half of it is not something you wanna give up without a fight. So, the question these guys were after was actually not about main memory bandwidth, it was about amortizing the cost of interrupts. And if you imagine that the processor takes a minimum of 1,000 cycles to handle an interrupt, right, and you have a processor of a given rate, and by the way, that 1,000 is going up as the processor speeds go up, because it's mostly driven by memory latencies. Then you can easily imagine that if I drove the processor hard enough, if I interrupted it often enough, right, that I would basically spend all of my time taking interrupts and none of my time actually doing anything useful. Right? So this is like trying to drink when somebody points a fire hose at your mouth. Right? You're not going to get a lot of water. So what they said is they made a distinction in the paper between what they called unscheduled interrupts, okay? That is, let the card interrupt me when it has something to say. Okay. And polled interrupts. Now, I should add, these cards do have a FIFO on them. So it's not actually that you're even getting hit every packet. You're getting hit whenever the FIFO hits a certain threshold. That's a programmable threshold within the limits of the FIFO. But even then, that's only taking a constant factor off the interrupt rate. And with line speeds this high, you can still drive the processor comfortably to the edge and a good bit over. Okay. So, what they observed is, look, there comes a point when the packets are coming so hard that there's no point taking an interrupt yet.
What's the point?
There comes a point when the packets are coming so hard that there's no point taking an interrupt. If you go to the card and look, I promise you a packet will be there. Okay? At which point, I don't need an interrupt to tell me to pay attention. I know I've got to go look. Okay? So, what they said is, look, you can, and they didn't actually lay it out in the graph in the chart. They said, look, you can draw a graph, okay? And one line, right, is the packet flow. And correlated with the packet flow, right, there's another line which rises with the interrupt rate, which is the CPU overhead for taking the interrupts. These are on different axes, right? So the packet flow is measured in packets per second, and the interrupts is measured in interrupts per second. Right? So think of this as this line, right, is correlated with this axis. Right? And that line's correlated with that axis. Now, the other strategy for not taking interrupts, the alternative, is to say, well, I won't take interrupts. Instead of taking interrupts, I will go and I will simply check the card every so often to see if there's something to do. Okay, that's called polling. And what happens if you poll when you have low load is it's not very efficient. You spend a lot of time checking for packets that aren't there. Okay? But the cost of the polling in terms of overhead, interrupt overhead, so let me be careful. This is the cycles per second that are attributable to the interrupts alone, not to processing the packets. So the cost of processing the packets is in addition to this. The cost of polling is a constant. Because you're saying, I'm going to go every so often and I'm going to check the card. And depending on how you set every so often, that's going to determine what your overhead is. Okay. Well, so what they observe is there's a crossing line. Okay. And this crossing line is going to exist for any source of unsolicited interrupts where the interrupt rate can exceed a certain capacity. What the capacity is depends on your CPU. In fact, it depends on your CPU and your cache configuration and your main memory configuration. Okay. But the result of this paper basically is, look, what you actually want to do is switch regimes. Right? At some threshold when the interrupt rises, I don't need any more interrupts to tell me there's work to do. I should just switch to a poll strategy. Right? And then as the packet rate falls again, I'll have another threshold where I'll say, okay, the rate has fallen, I should switch back to an interrupt strategy. And there are drivers in the Linux kernel that do this, right? And they got the idea from this work.
Okay. They work better?
What's that?
And they show...
Dramatic improvement. Really dramatic.
I remember reading like the first big SD, 10 gig, when even the drivers to work, this had to be done.
Oh, to get 10 gig Ethernet drivers to work at all?
You could have 10 gig Ethernet drivers that could work at 100 megabits otherwise.
Like right, that. And on modern hardware, you could probably push that to about 850. But that's about where the CPU craps out.
How long ago was this done?
This work was done, I want to say 94, 95. Might have been 93. Okay. So, look, this isn't, I mean, as much as I would like to sort of, conceptually speaking, kind of, you know, pat my advisor and Brendan Trott on the back and say, this is really good work, okay? In fact, this is a very old idea, right? Reapplied, you know, really good engineering work, reapplied to networking, okay? In fact, I think I told you the story of the first time I encountered this idea, which was on the VAX in 1984. Okay, when they switched to from a terminal line driver that interrupted per character to one that actually interrupted every four characters, had a little bit of a FIFO, right? This is the FIFO story all over again. Interrupts are expensive. And what's new here is the polling. There were systems running PDP-11 processors in which polling was a recognized technique, and people did this sort of thing. Right, and as the processors got faster, the technique fell out of use, and it fell out of people's sensibilities about how to design. And then as the ratio of devices to processors came back, it came back into vogue, and these guys published this result. This is a sitcom publication. A couple of years later, there was a SOSPI publication that essentially reproduced this result and got best paper for it, having failed to cite this paper, which was disgusting. And that, by the way, is not a failure of the SOSPI paper. It was a student paper, and it was a good piece of work, okay? But it was derelict on the part of the SOSPI committee. It's a strong word, and I really mean it. It was derelict. Okay, now, so what did I pick on him for? So I picked on him for this word unscheduled. These interrupts are not unscheduled. And in the context of the book chapter and in the context of the paper, where the term unscheduled is being used in contrast to polled, where in fact you are explicitly letting the scheduler decide, or some scheduler decide, when you're going to check for the interrupts. The question is, what scheduler? Okay. And I want to suggest that in fact, these interrupts were always scheduled. And in fact, that was the problem, that they were scheduled wrong. So when we think about just an ordinary, conventional process scheduler, just take a really simple one where we have a set of static priorities. Okay. And then the standard thing is you augment the static priority scheduler by allowing some dynamic motion in the priority scheme so that a process that, you know, is doing certain things gets penalized, process is doing certain other things gets given an advantage so that it'll get out of the way. Okay? But all these dynamic adjustments fall within the range of the process scheduler. What I want to point out to you is there's another scheduler in the system. Because the system has something called an interrupt controller. That interrupt controller itself implements a priority scheme. And you can usually set it to flat, but that's not the usual behavior. One of those interrupts is associated with system interval timer. That's the one that drives the process scheduler. Right? The clock hangs on a pin and says, time to switch. However, suppose I'm running this process that's the very highest priority process in the system. And the disk drive completes an I.O. and it says, I'm done, pay attention. Well, we get an interrupt in, okay? And that interrupt preempts this high priority process because the hardware doesn't know about the soft scheduler, okay? And all of a sudden, we're running the disk drive. Or at least we're running the low-level handler. At the very least, we're going to run enough code to acknowledge to the hardware chip that we took the interrupt. In fact, in monolithic systems, we are then actually going to run the bottom half of the disk driver in the kernel. Now, if you stop and think about this, you will conclude that what just happened is we built a two-level scheduler. Okay. And what we now have really ought to be thought of as a unified scheduler, okay, in which the so-called bottom halves have higher priority than any process in the system. And some of these bottom halves do a non-trivial amount of processing, although they're not supposed to. If you go into the BSD kernels, right, you'll discover that there's an explicit scheduling of these drivers, right? You'll find that there's a set of routines, SPL something, right? SPL net, SPL TPY. Historically, there's a list of these things. Okay. And these amount to set priority level. What these are saying is which interrupts can preempt which other interrupts. This is being done in software. Why? Because if I have a long-running bottom half and I take another interrupt, and I have a long-running bottom half and I take another interrupt, and I have a long-running bottom half and I take another interrupt, sooner or later I'm going to run out of stack. Running out of stack in the kernel is not a recoverable error. So the purpose of this SPL scheme is to guarantee that there is a total bound on the number of interrupts that can possibly be on the stack at once, so that you can plan the maximum stack you might need. Now, if you stop and think about this, this is very weird, right? So the question you should be asking is, well, why did we have two priority schemes? These could have been unified. And the answer is, well, that's sort of not the history of how this stuff was built, but in fact, you can do it. So I claim it's not that these interrupts were unscheduled. They were in fact scheduled. Right? It's that we didn't schedule them explicitly. So this was the nit that I was picking on the terminology in this chapter. Now, the reason I raised this is that it sort of ties into the discussion of drivers and DMA, because I want to show you what's the alternative. When the interrupt comes in, we know two things, right? One, We know we're going to have to handle this interrupt. We also know, by the way, that once we know we got to handle the interrupt, we don't need to be told again. So the very first step when an interrupt comes in is we disable that interrupt line, because there's no point taking any more interrupts on that interrupt line until we handle the interrupt that's already pending, and we're about to go do that. Okay. That's a one-time cost per interrupt. And if we disable the interrupt line, right, yes, there's a one-time cost, but we're not going to take any more cost related to that interrupt until we handle it. So, what's done in Kyotos and in Eros and in many microkernels, although not all, yeah, I did do part of this, is the interrupt comes in and its number is used to index into a list of queues, okay, and the corresponding driver has done a wait for interrupt on that queue. Interrupt comes in, we mask off the line, we wake up the driver on that queue, that's it, we return back to the application. Now, I gotta be really precise here. Wake up the driver does not mean set it running. Wake up the driver means put it on the ready queue to be scheduled according to the rules of the scheduler. At some later time, this driver will run. It will go dink with the hardware, right? And eventually it will come back and say, now re-enable the interrupt line, I'm done. And I'm ready for the next interrupt. Now, something really kind of interesting just happened. What we've just done, we still in some sense have a two-level scheduler because we still are going to take those low-level interrupts, you know, in this very high priority scheme. But I want to show you a picture about now what's going on. Okay? If you think about the flow of execution in the machine, we had a high priority app. What we wanted was it for it to run unmolested until its slicer ran out. We didn't quite get that. Okay? The reason we didn't quite get that is because in the middle of running this app, we got a low-level interrupt request, and that was preempted. Right? And that led to a wake up, and that led to somebody being put on the ready queue. But if we're running a real-time scheduler, that somebody's not going to run next because we still own the process. Now, presumably, drivers are going to be relatively high-priority tasks in a real system. So with some likelihood, the next thing we're going to switch to is probably the driver. But something to notice about this is that from the time we take that interrupt to the time the driver is done executing, that interrupt can't happen again because it has not been re-enabled. A consequence of this is that logically, we can rearrange this picture. It's not now a description of timing, it's a description of attribution of timing. We can take this low-level interrupt block, and we can say, okay, this low-level interrupt, it's part of the scheduling of the driver. And for accounting purposes, we know that during the time when this high priority application is running, when it's not preemptible because it knows the schedule, that there's a limited number of interrupts you can take because there's a limited supply of pins. Now, what that means is, if we wanted to say, well, look, we really need to guarantee that this application gets a certain amount of microseconds of execution, notwithstanding interrupts. One thing we could do is say, we will build into the plan, we'll allow for these extra interrupts to occur. We can actually plan them into the schedule. And the reason we can plan them into the schedule is because we know the relationship between the interrupts and the drivers. And that means we effectively have a rate control on the interrupts, and that makes them schedulable. Now something interesting just happened. Now the problem of unscheduled interrupts has gone away, because we've scheduled them explicitly. I would argue that the need for polled interrupts has also gone away. Remember that the reason that we were scheduling these interrupts was that the interrupts were overwhelming us. But if we disable them and only process them at known intervals, they can't overwhelm us, because we're not going to take them too fast. And we're going to say explicitly in the scheduler, we're willing to dedicate the following amount of energy to pulling packets off the wire. And that's all we're willing to give. And if we can't get the packets, too damn bad. That's all we're willing to give. And we'll miss some packets. And the higher level protocols will back off. And that's what the whole scheme is for. So the critique I have of this approach is that it's the wrong solution to the problem. The right solution is to fuse the schedulers. I haven't gotten a response back from Jonathan on this, but yeah.
When the system that you're describing for scheduling all the interrupts, that includes the low-level interrupts?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know when they're going to come, but I know how many there can be, and I know that they can't recur until the corresponding driver is run.
Okay. But don't they start out as turned on, so that it's...
Yes.
So you still have the possibility that it's going to come in the middle of your application?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, I will still take the low-level handler in the middle of the application, but here's what I'm really saying, okay? What I'm really saying is, look, that low-level handler takes a fixed amount of time. It has nothing to do with the device.
So when you say schedule interrupts, you don't mean the low-level handlers. You mean the device driver part of it.
Well, in fact, we could schedule the low-level interrupts as well, but I'm not proposing that we do that. I'm proposing that what we do is we say, I know that there's a cycle of these things. I know the low-level handler takes a bounded amount of time, and I know there's a maximum number of low-level handlers that can go off during a given scheduling slice. Let me just build some extra fuzz into the scheduling slice to allow for it.
Under which scheme did you say you're going to lose some packets too bad?
If you don't allocate enough time to the driver and it doesn't get to the wire in time, you're going to get partial packets. Right? They're going to run off the back of your FIFO. But if you don't have the processing capacity to process them, you're going to lose them anyway. We're only arguing about where. Better to lose them early and not run all the code in the networking stack to discover at the top that you don't have enough bandwidth to handle them. I mean, if you're going to lose state, you want to lose it as early as possible, because the less work you do not processing it, the happier you're going to be. Now, I'm going to take this a step further. Part of what we're saying here, curiously enough, is that actually it doesn't matter when I take the interrupt, because I'm not prepared to handle it until the slice for the driver comes anyway. All I'm going to do is ignore it. Right? I'm going to mask the line. And then I'm not going to do anything else. I'm going to schedule a driver. Well, you know, the thing about interrupt lines is when the interrupt line yanks on my pin, it's going to keep yanking until I acknowledge it. And that means I don't have to leave it enabled. I could, in fact, take this schedule. Sorry, I'm going to compress it because I don't want to throw away that graph. What happens if I take this schedule and I just rearrange it? And I put the low-level interrupt, the acknowledgement of the low-level interrupt, I put it at the end of the application. Put it just before the driver. Okay? So now what I'm saying is, I'm only even going to consider this interrupt when the driver comes up for scheduling.
Does that mean that the driver is always in the ready queue?
No. No. Here's what it means. It means that I'm actually going to schedule two blocks of time independently. Okay? One is the interrupt block of time, and that one's always ready, and that one occurs in the kernel. Okay? And that's a point in the schedule. It is the point in the schedule where I go and I unmask the interrupt to check if an interrupt is ready. If it's ready, I'll immediately run the low-level handler, which will put this guy back on the ready queue. This guy's slice will then come immediately after the handler, and I'll discover, yep, the guy's ready, and I'll run the driver, or I won't discover he's ready, and I won't run the driver. We're now doing clock interrupts, right? We're doing polled interrupts fused with the scheduler. So here's a curious thing you could do, and this is now sort of going back to the mixed idea. You'd say, okay, I have a schedule to consider the interrupt. Now what's the cost? Well, the cost is every so often I'm going to interrupt the processor, I'm going to check the pin, and I'm going to decide if there's anything to do, and I'm going to do that in the low-level handler. If that takes several thousand cycles, now here's the cool part. I actually want to run my scheduler in two regimes. One regime is the regime where I only check according to the schedule. That's the one when I'm above the necessary rate threshold. The other regime is the regime where I'm not yet above the necessary rate threshold. And if I'm not yet above the necessary rate threshold, I should just take the interrupt in the background because I'm going to take fewer of them than the schedule has planned for. So in the what Smith and Traw call the unscheduled case, what I'm going to do is I'm going to allow some slop. And when the interrupt rate comes up, I'll simply convert modes, but I'll do it in the scheduler proper. So I'm suggesting here that if you've got a good real-time scheduler, the real-time scheduling table ought to include the interrupt polling information. There's another kind of activity that you want to schedule here, and it's not an execution of a process. It's an execution of a low-level code frame.
So really what that is it's not one interrupt request after the app. It's all that you got during
No. I really mean we're going to check just the one.
So you're going to check just the one and then run the corresponding driver code for that one?
No, I'm going to check the one, and I'm going to conditionally run the driver code because the driver code has a slice. But I don't want to run it if there's nothing to do. I'd rather donate it slice to, you know, to opportunistic computation if there's nothing to do. Now, in fact, sorry, I'm going to come back to what you said because you're on the trail of something that's the right idea here. Yeah.
I didn't understand the part about introducing slop into the.
Okay, so look, the only reason to schedule these interrupts is if I'm getting a lot of them. If I'm only getting two of these a second, they don't present enough disruption that I should care. Okay, so what I really want to do is build an overall schedule that says, look, I'm going to get 10 random interrupts, okay? I don't know when they're going to come. I'm just going to build it into the schedule and allow for them, okay? And they're going to disrupt things, and the way those are going to manifest, the way I'm going to think about them in the real-time scheduler, I'm going to think about them as schedule overrun. So if you have a contract for 50 microseconds, and I'm saying, I'm going to assume a distribution of interrupts, in your 50 microseconds, I might get two. Those two are going to add up to another 2 microseconds max. So here's what we're going to do. I'm going to give you 50 microseconds, but I'm going to allow for 52. And I'm not going to bill you for the time spent in the interrupt. If the interrupts don't come, you'll get a free microsecond. As the interrupt rate climbs, right, I'm going to switch regimes and put them in the scheduling regime.
And that's now, what we get.
What?
Once you put them into the scheduling, that's when you get that?
Yes.
Okay.
Right. So I have to have planned in the schedule for the schedule slots to check these things. But the hope is that except when I'm under pressure, these are going to be processes, elements in the schedule that are actually never ready to run. See the model? Okay, now back to your question about multiple interrupts. So, right, what's the cost in these low-level interrupt routines? Well, it turns out that all of the cost in these low-level interrupt routines is the cost to get into and out of the damn kernel. Once I'm in the kernel, yeah, I should check for all of them. It was 1,000 cycles in and out of the kernel, it's about 10 cycles in interrupt to check. Something very small. I mean, maybe it's not 10. I haven't actually done the measurement, but it's something small. Okay? So now we're going to play amortization tricks. And we're going to discover that we have some one interrupt that if we're polling at all, this interrupt's going to be the one that we're polling for. And simply because we're polling for it, as a side effect, we're going to poll for a bunch of lower priority interrupts. Which means they don't have to be scheduled separately. So the funny part is, these high-speed interrupts, we can trade the cost of their low-level handlers and actually exploit them to not run other low-level handlers that have to be scheduled. Because it was actually the cost of the interrupt, the cost of entering the kernel, that was killing us. Now, some hardware is more friendly to this scheme than other hardware. But the protocol is, you come into the kernel, the process says, I got interrupt 8. And the usual convention is you go out to the interrupt controller and say, mask off interrupt 8. But one of the things that you can do is you can go to the controller and say, look, just tell me the list of pending interrupts you have that you know about. And I know what your current mask is, right? And anything in the delta, I'll now make a note of, and because I've already made a note of everything in the mask. So anything in the delta list, I'll now make a note of, and I'll just mask all of those. Because once I know they're there, right, there's no point coming back into the kernel to discover something I already knew. All right. So the point here is you actually desperately want to fuse this processing into the scheduler. And the operative word is the scheduler. So when you're trying to build a serious real-time scheduler, the scheduler doesn't operate on processes. It operates on kernel activities. But that's not the way we present schedulers in the IntroLS course, for sure. And we don't talk about this at all. And this is stuff that's serious bleeding edge stuff, right? This is stuff that you only need this kind of technique when you're drowning. Right. But it turns out we have lots of devices that have that problem. Right. Gigabit Ethernet can push a current generation pendulum flat up against the wall and pin its neck to the wall and say, breathe! Okay, question, Victor?
Yeah, so you have the non-microkernel systems, you run the interrupt handler and then you actually do the driver code. But in this, if you And the problem there is running driver, driver code after driver, driver code running in the stack. This way, if you wake up all your interrupts,
not quite. go ahead and finish your question.
Also, I was just thinking that if you get the same problem here because you
no, but here the driver here is application code. It's running on its own stack and it's running on a disjoint stack from any other driver. Now the cost of that is we're actually paying more memory because we're keeping all the stacks in memory, and they're mostly unused at any given time, right? In the same way that a process that's waiting for something to do, right, has elements in its heap and elements in its stack that are not currently being utilized.
Right, but it used to be that because the interrupts had higher priorities than any other application, and they could take so now you're saying the driver code doesn't have to always preempt every application because the interrupts get handled and you land the drivers in a regular schedule.
That's right. Now, going back to how monolithic systems do this, let me describe the mechanism, at least the mechanism that used to exist in the Linux kernel, and there are variants of this mechanisms in other Unix kernels, and I'll tell you about one of the variants. So in the historical Linux kernel, and Eric, correct me if this has changed since then, it used to be that drivers had what was known as a lower half or upper half and a bottom half. Right? And I think the names have changed, but the bottom half is the part that runs at interrupt time. Okay, and the upper half is the part that allegedly does all of the expensive processing. Now, there's a catch in this design, and the catch is that each driver writer is tempted to optimize for performance and do just a little more in the bottom half, particularly when you have a smart device, you want to queue up the next activity if you've got a queue of activities to go. Any one of these optimizations is probably okay. But when you do several hundred of them across several different driver authors, they begin to add up and they begin to constitute real cost in the system. Eric, has that basic design changed? And I know the labels have changed. Okay, there's another optimization that was done here. I know about it in HPUX, but I know it's been done in other systems. And it has to do with shared interrupts. That I get an interrupt and it says, you got an interrupt on logical line 5, but logical line 5 may be attributed to any of several cards. Okay. What I'd really like to do, because I'm going to disable the line, but it's actually not the line I want to disable, it's actually the card I want to disable. What I'd really like to say is, until further notice, ignore interrupts from this card. Okay. So in HPUX, there's actually a second stage low-level handler that knows just enough to identify the card and disable that. The problem is it's driver-specific code. And this is going to bring us to the DPF and the EDF idea, which I'm going to pick up on tomorrow. So if you haven't read those papers, get to them. Okay, they're on the syllabus. Did that answer your question, though, about? Okay. Other questions on this? Yeah.
I'm not sure that I understood. So if we're doing the scheduling of the low-level interrupts, if we're scheduling one, we're scheduling them all? Was that the...
You don't have to go that far. So what does it mean to schedule a low-level interrupt? What it means is, at this moment in the scheduler, and only at this moment, you're going to enable those interrupt pins. Okay. Now, if there's an interrupt live, you're immediately going to get hit with an interrupt on the processor. You won't even make it out of the enable code. Okay. So what happened, or in fact, rather than enable them, you actually could instead of enabling them and taking the interrupt, because you're already in the kernel if you're running the scheduler, you could just pull the controller, right? Because in effect, what we've done is clock the interrupt here. Now, having pulled the controller, right, the next question is, well, all right, I'm already here, I'm already fiddling around with the controller. When I go to the controller and say, what interrupts have you got pending, I'm actually going to get back, for most controllers, I'm going to get back a bit mask. Right? Now, I've got this bit mask in my paws, and I'm really only interested in one bit right at the moment, but if I happen to notice that three other bits are set that I could deal with right here, you know, and the net marginal work is an additional to waking up one queue, I'm going to wake up two other queues, shit, man, I'll save myself enough work in the cache misses that I might as well do it. Because the cost of coming back here later to notice those other interrupts just completely overwhelmed by these extra cache misses is much, much larger than, you know, doing the extra three passes through the bit check loop. So there is an amortization question. How much judicial notice should I take? Right? And I don't have an answer to that. My sense is the minute I see an interrupt pending, I should particularly if it's not a clocked interrupt, because if it's clocked, it's already masked and I'm gonna deal with it later when the clock comes, right? But if it's not clocked and I notice it's pending at a moment when I'm doing a pulp check, oh hell yeah, I want to mask it out, because why should I come into the kernel again to be told something I already know now? I just saved 1,000 cycles by testing one extra bit. That was a win. Right. And you know, for large values of 1,000, right, as the processors get faster, the interrupt overhead gets higher. Does that answer your question?
If the driver after it runs according to schedule, only after it runs re-enables by a queue, it may not be ideal in multiprocessor because there are two drivers that are running parallel. And if you
what do you mean if there are two drivers, they may not be parallel?
No, I'm saying if there are two applications running the same driver code on a multiprocessor.
There can't be two applications sharing the same driver code on the same device.
So I was thinking on a multiprocessor, if there are two drivers, they can run on the two processors, and if one is holding the interrupt till it finishes, the other is going to wait.
There can't be two drivers sharing an interrupt line. Not at this level. If you're running two drivers that are ultimately servicing the same card on two processors, it's time to crash because something's badly, badly wrong. Now, the scenario that's close to what you say, and there is a hazard here, but it's a fundamental hazard. But here's the scenario. I have two different cards. The different cards are on a shared interrupt line. Okay? So indeed, I mask the shared line because I don't use the second stage low-level interrupt trick from HPUX. So I mask the shared line. Both cards are now masked. And indeed, the driver for the second card will not get any slice until the driver for the first card is done. Okay? This was an unavoidable outcome of the decision to share the interrupt line. What's the alternative? The alternative is you re-enable the interrupt early. Guess what's going to happen? The first card has not yet deasserted its interrupt. So you're immediately going to get hit with the same interrupt again from the first card. Now what you have is a phantom interrupt. You see the problem? Okay. So what do you do about it? What you really like is a very fast way to demultiplex the interrupt back to the card, disable the card, and then re-enable the line. I agree that you'd like that. It turns out there's a way to do that. In fact, there are a couple of ways to do that, and that's what I'm going to take up with tomorrow. You are onto something. But let's be clear that this is something that is important under a very narrow set of circumstances. One, you're multiprocessing. Two, you have a shared interrupt line with two high-frequency devices, right? And three, you don't have the second-level handler driving the card. And four, your drivers are impossibly slow. Right? Or your schedule isn't getting them to them fast enough. Okay. So yeah, now, it turns out you can line up those circumstances fairly easily. Drivers are complicated. It's not obvious how to schedule them. So there's a real issue here, and we'll talk about it tomorrow. I want to point out one other thing, though. So there's a curious attribute that happens when you start scheduling the drivers. Right? A consequence, suppose this was the Ethernet driver. So what we just said is, we know that incoming packets are only going to happen at certain times. And so we know that there is a good time and a bad time to run the upwards TCP/IP stack. Okay. When you start regulating and doing rate control and timing control on the sources of input, there's a whole bunch of cascading consequences in terms of when everything else needs to run. One of the artifacts that Mercer and Takuda noticed, Mothy Roscoe and Ian Hand and Alan Hoyden noticed when they did the Nemesis schedulers, the idea with the Nemesis scheduler, it's this style of scheduler, the capacity reserve scheduler, except that instead of the applications negotiating for slice, the user says what slice the application can have, and if the application can't get the work done, it gives up. Here's the really weird part. Okay, everybody who's done a schedule like this has noticed there's some fraction where after you schedule that fraction of the CPU, it's not all the CPU you could schedule. You suddenly discover that everything else is falling into line two. Because as you make commitments to part of the schedule, right, by omission, you're also making commitments to where the variable parts of the schedule will live. And that tends to cause the rest of the ducklings to be forced to more or less line up. All right, we'll come back to this tomorrow. Thanks.